Good morning. How many of you has the coffee yet to hit the bloodstream? How many are there? Okay, so we got a few. The rest of you, you seem like you're in good shape. I hope your experience, if you're new to this area and your experience with Atlanta traffic this morning, I hope it wasn't too bad. It's pretty rough here at times, but really glad that you guys are here. Thanks for being here. I know it's a lot of energy and effort to be here, and hopefully this morning there's some things that I can share that maybe help you with something you're dealing with. But my name's Justin Elam, and I've held a variety of roles here, and I worked in adult ministries for the last 10 years. But really, it's, as far as this breakout goes, just working with people is a part of this. Whether you're managing people, whether you're in ministry, whether it's just friendships and relationships, whether it's your marriage, just being around people and working with people means that there's going to be difficult conversations because people are different, and those differences can be leveraged for a lot of positive things, and they can also lead to a lot of conflict. So any of you, I'm in any, you know, relational ministry, any kind of relationships you have, I know you face this. We all face this. And the reason that I'm talking about this morning is not because I'm an expert at it. So for those of you that are in the middle or getting ready to have a difficult conversation and you're hoping for a formula that's going to make that go really, really easily, I'm not going to be able to help you. But the reason I'm talking about it is because I have a lot of experience with it. And part of that is because my personality type is one that sort of seems to attract a lot of conflict. So I have a lot of experience. In fact, some of you, part of our evaluation process here at North Point is we periodically take 360 evaluations where our peers speak into our lives. And on my most recent one, somebody wrote, "Justin has a conflict-friendly personality." So there was a time in my life where I would have received that as a compliment, because I know this is not probably most people in this room, but for those of you that resonate or are wired like I am, you kind of feel a sense of, you know, I'm willing to have the conversations no one else is. And there's a little bit of pride in that, and it didn't mean that any of those really went well. It's just that I was willing to have them, and it was sort of a point of pride to kind of say, well, you guys don't have the courage to do it, I'll do it, you know, kind of thing. But what happened was I wasn't doing it well, and there was a lot of banged up and bruised and broken people that were kind of in the wake of my ministry. And I found myself having to clean up my own messes quite a bit and say I'm sorry quite a bit. And there was a time, I think, where the Lord started to open my eyes towards just the unhealth of that. And it really sent me on a personal journey of sort of trying to figure out how to do that better. And so what I'm going to share with you this morning is what I've learned to this point about how to do that better for me. And I'm hoping that as I share with what I've learned, that maybe that helps you. So let me start by telling you about one such conversation that took place. There was a colleague that was hired onto the North Point staff a few years ago, and his name was Tim. He was hired as he was a peer, and he was in a different part of the church, but we were peers. And Tim's one of these guys that is one of these few people that I've met in life that every single person likes. They have everyone they've met as a friend, unbelievably skilled relationally, funny, good time, great conversationalist, can relate to every type of person, probably is up there near the top 1% on Facebook friends, and, you know, all that stuff. Just an unbelievably fun guy. And when he was hired on staff, we were again peers, so the focus of our relationship was on a peer level, and we were getting to know each other and really enjoying that friendship, and that was building. And then some roles changed, and suddenly I found myself in a position where Tim was no longer a peer, but he was reporting to me. And so a lens kind of dropped into that relationship that wasn't just a friendship lens, it was a work lens. And I was starting to evaluate Tim, not just as my friend, but as someone who was on a team that I was leading. And there were some things I started to notice about Tim's work that were bothering me, and they weren't going away. And I started to get into this tension where I felt like I started to need to talk to Tim about it, but at the same time, I didn't want to disrupt the relationship because we had this great friendship, and I knew that if I were to have the conversation that I felt like I was needing to have, it would disrupt that and cause problems, and I was sort of weighing that. But it wasn't going away, and it was getting more and more challenging, and I realized that it was starting to affect our friendship. Like I felt like I was starting to treat Tim poorly, not in fairness to him, but because I was harboring this undealt with stuff. And so I realized we needed to have this conversation. So we go out for our one-on-one, and you know, Tim's in a great mood. He's always in a great mood, and he can't wait to talk about sports. And I feel like I'm getting ready to drop a rock on his head, you know, and we're driving to Buffalo Wild Wings, and he wants to talk about sports and family, and I know we're going to talk about something hard. So one thing that's different about that conversation from maybe 5-10 years previous was what I'm about to share with you played a role in how I had that conversation that was different than previously. And it didn't go perfectly, and it wasn't done perfectly, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about, is it never can be, it can always be done better, but it went better than it had in the past for some reason. So some of you in this breakout, either you've had difficult conversations and you want to do them better, you know you're going to have one, or you think you're going to have them in the future, and you want to do them better. And some of you I talked to this morning were sent here by members of your staff that said, you need to learn how to do this. So however you got here, I'm glad you're here. So Roman numeral one, an unavoidable reality. An unavoidable reality. As we talked about at the top, the nature of hard conversations is that they're just an unavoidable reality, that since the fall, our differences have affected our relationships. But the truth is, that's actually not a totally true statement, is it? Because some of us have gotten really, really good at avoiding difficult conversations, right? I used to work on a church staff, and I will tell you, we were the Jedi Knights of conflict avoidance. And you can imagine what a bull in a china shop I was on that staff. But that, we did not confront each other at all. And it didn't lead to a healthy culture, but what it taught me was you can avoid difficult conversations for a very long time. So maybe unavoidable is not the best word, but inevitable is probably a better word. And it's been inevitable since the garden, and it's been a part of church since the beginning. I mean, as soon as the church started, you have conflict over who's going to serve the widows. You have conflict between, in Galatians 2, you have Paul telling people that he had to confront Peter publicly because Peter wasn't willing to eat with Gentiles when the Judaizers were present. So imagine that. Imagine Paul standing up publicly and confronting Peter. So there's confrontation there. That same Paul has a falling out with Barnabas over another guy. So we see it everywhere. So it's been a part of ministry, the church, relationships from the beginning. Letter A, genuine love is incomplete without difficult conversations. Genuine love is incomplete without difficult conversations. You know, I think that part of what it means to really, really love somebody is to be willing to have these. And you guys feel this, and I feel this when we talk to people, and sometimes when people describe their best friendships, they'll say something like, you know, he's the person that's willing to tell me the things, or she's the person that's willing to tell me the things that no one else is willing to tell me. And when we say that, or someone says that, that's actually an expression of that's that person loving me. They go beyond what others are willing to do and tell me those things. And we're not saying that in a negative way. We're saying that because somebody's loving us that extra mile. And we see this with our children. I mean, long before my children were old enough to understand why I was disciplining them at times, I had to stop them from running out in the street randomly. And I would discipline them to do that. And that was an act of love, even though they didn't necessarily feel that. In the adult world, an extreme version of this is if any of you have ever been related to or maybe know someone who was trapped in addiction and a group of family and friends got together and said, hey, we have got to intervene or this person's going to destroy their lives or destroy other people. Well, they have an intervention. And an intervention is an extreme act of love on the part of the family, even though it doesn't feel that way to the person at the time. So connecting this back to my story with Tim, like, I had done some math prior to that conversation because I wanted to figure out how can I avoid this? How can I avoid this conversation and keep our friendship intact? What could I do strategically? And so I had thought through, was there another role I could move Tim to that would be kind of on another team and we could maintain our friendship, or at least I thought we could try. Not that he wouldn't figure out what was going on, but you know what I mean? So maybe I could move him to another team and he could do what he does well over there, and I wouldn't ever have to have the full hard conversation that I thought I had to have. So I thought about that, and I thought about there was a role that I thought was a really, really good fit for him that may even be in a better fit in some ways. But I also thought, I knew our organization well enough to know that eventually over there, Tim was going to confront the same things I was seeing. And I knew that that manager or someone else was eventually going to be brought to the same place I was to have a conversation with him. And I felt like if our relationship was really going to have true integrity, that I had to have this conversation. If I really, really did care about Tim, then ultimately, as hard as this was going to be, that the loving thing to do was to be the one to tell him. And I had a friendship with him, and I didn't know if I were to move him on, if that would happen as well or at all. And many of you, and myself included, have been in situations where there was something someone needed to tell us, but they couldn't or wouldn't, and we moved on in our careers until we hit a really hard wall. And then finally somebody said, hey, I don't know if anyone's told you this, but I need to tell you this. And suddenly it was clear this was true all along, but no one had really told us. So I felt like I needed to do that for Tim. So it was connected to being actually loving, even though I know it didn't feel that way on the day that it happened. Number one, biblical love involves grace and truth. You know, Jesus was both gracious and he was truthful. And a lot of times we focus on the things that Jesus said that were radically gracious, and rightfully so. But Jesus said just as many things that were incredibly blunt, to the point that the disciples were saying to him, hey man, you may want to back off the directness a little bit. You're offending people. So Jesus was both, and I think we're called to be both. And I think it's something that we in the church have gotten really, really bad at. And we don't do really well. I mean, I think one of the most ignored biblical instructions is the Matthew 18 instruction to confront a brother or sister caught in sin. I think that's one of the things I see practiced, one of the most rare practiced commands in the Bible, because we don't like to do that. This doesn't go well. It's hard. It disrupts relationships. And so what happens is, rather than call ourselves, you know, conflict avoiding or condemn ourselves for not doing what we feel like we should do, a lot of times what I see happen in church world and Christianity is we call our avoiding it grace or mercy or love. We stuff it down and say, you know, I mean, I could have easily said, you know, I don't need to have this conversation with Tim. I just need to do the gracious thing and kind of let that be. But really, that's not what was going on. I would love to have labeled it that to avoid it, but I think what happens is Christians sort of have this propensity to make nice rather than deal with these kind of things. And there's a problem with that, because number two, niceness leads to artificial harmony and ultimately to unhealth. What happens is there's things that happen all the time in our relationship. Some of them roll right off, like that was an annoying thing that person just did, but I forget about it an hour later, a day later. But there's other things that we don't forget about, we carry with us, and they bother us, and they're a pebble in our shoe. And what happens over time is a gap begins to develop between how we act and how we feel. Because if this person, our chemistry with this person, our problems with this person begin to increase, like we feel the necessity to be nice to their face, but privately we're starting to leak. Whether it's in our thoughts, we're having these imaginary conversations, or we're talking to other people, you know, we're in the meeting, we're all playing nice, we're asking how their family is, and then we go over here and say, can you believe she said, can you believe he said, you know? And so privately we're not. And what happens is over time that builds sort of an artificial harmony, this kind of phony getting along. And it looks fine outwardly, but it really isn't. And what happens in organizations is artificial harmony creates an unhealthy culture. And over time, an unhealthy culture can undermine an organization. There's a consultant, some of you have read his books, Patrick Lencioni, and he recently wrote a book called The Advantage. And The Advantage really for him is the sum total of his learning in organizational consulting. So this is a great book to read in terms of, this is a really bright guy, he's a man of faith, he has a heart for the church, and he's talking about all that he's observed in organizations. And listen to his comment on this. In all of the organizations I've studied, I found there's a continuum of sorts. At one end of that continuum is no conflict at all. I call this artificial harmony because it's marked by a lot of false smiling and disingenuous agreement around just about everything, at least publicly. Nowhere does this tendency towards artificial harmony show itself more than in mission-driven nonprofit organizations, most notably churches. People who work in those organizations tend to have a misguided idea that they cannot be frustrated or disagreeable with one another. What they're doing is confusing being nice with being kind, and I would say being loving versus being kind. Two people who trust and care about one another and are engaged in something as important that sure sounds like mission-driven nonprofits to me, should feel compelled to disagree with one another, sometimes passionately, when they see things differently. After all, the consequences of making bad decisions are great. When leaders fail to disagree around issues, not only are they increasing the likelihood of losing respect for one another and encountering destructive conflict later when people start griping in the hallways, they're also making bad decisions and letting down the people they're supposed to be serving. And they do this all in the name of being nice. So, letter B, difficult conversations are a vital part of our personal growth process. I believe what I've seen and experienced is that your potential and my potential and capacity as leaders are directly connected to our ability to master this. If this is a skill you are unwilling or unable to develop, it will put a lid on your capacity and ability to lead. Because leaders, most leaders, and the leadership story that you're writing and I'm writing, what's really going to define that is not how we celebrated the wins and the victories, because it's not hard to lead the victory parade. What leaders are defined by is how they respond to difficult situations. And oftentimes, when people describe the legacy of a leader, it's not all the home runs they hit. It's a lot how they handled the really hard things. And so I think it not only defines who we are as leader, it really determines at what level we reach in our capacity to lead. Number one, they're a kind of trial, and as you and I know, God used trials to grow us. That's the whole point of that James 1 passage, that we're to rejoice in trials. Why? Because trials, ultimately, if we persevere through them, they lead to maturity. Now, most ministry trials, unless you're doing ministry somewhere in a closed country, or there's definitely drama in ministry. There's trials in ministry. If you've been through a church split, or you've had leadership have a moral failing or something like that, those are some serious trials to navigate a church through. But day in and day out, what I've found is that most of what ministry trials look like in my role has to do with difficult conversations. This, for me, is kind of, and for most people I talk to, probably for most people in this room, difficult conversations represent a more regular experience of what trials look like in ministry. But as this passage is saying, and as I've observed, there's very little growth for me personally, and probably for you, without challenge, without depending on God through those trials. And that's the whole purpose of that, is to develop maturity in us. Number two, we'll never get better at it without doing it. I'll tell you this, the truth is, without having difficult conversations, you can never look back on them and go, okay, how could I have done that better? And you will always be able to find things you could do better. One thing I've seen is that there will always be room for improvement no matter how well you handle a difficult conversation. And I think if you can accept that and I can accept that, it's just a reality, then we can, at least by doing it, we can grow a little bit every time. As I look back on my conversation with Tim, even years removed from it, I look back and I think, I did that conversation was so much better than I would have handled it even 5 years previous. But I look back at it now and I go, there's definitely ways I could have handled it better the day that it happened. So there's always improvement, and we can't get better without doing it. Letter C, difficult conversations are the responsibility and expectation of leadership. Church leaders must guard what's been entrusted to us. That comes from 2 Timothy 1:14. And I think even though that passage is primarily talking about doctrine, if you read Paul's writings, Paul is not just concerned about doctrine. He's concerned about the church getting along. He's concerned about the culture of the church. He's commenting just as much in the epistles about the behavior of the church members towards one another as he is about the doctrine that they're protecting. And so I think Paul is just as concerned. I mean, think about where he says, you know, I plead with, at the end of, is it Philippians, where he says, I plead with Euodia and Syntyche to get along, right? So here he is, here's this epistle that's going to be part of the canon of Scripture for what would end up being thousands of years, and, you know, all of these verses we quote and form policy and doctrine on, and at the end it's like, hey, ladies, you know, get along. You know, that's part of that forever. And I kind of find that, I don't know if you guys think this way at all, but I find that so interesting that someday if we remember this stuff in heaven, we're going to meet these people, and it's going to be like, hey, I know we're in heaven and all, but what were y'all fighting about, you know? And I'll be tempted to go, who was right, really? Who was right? So we need to guard the doctrine and the church culture. Number two, a willingness to have a difficult conversation creates confidence and stability in those who follow. And you know this when you've had a leader do this for you, but the same is true for people that are looking to you. People that are following us, they're thinking the same thing. There's a man named Simon Sinek who wrote a book that I'm totally blanking on right now. Shout it out. What's the book that the? Oh, Start With Why. And he's recently wrote another leadership book. Look at this quote that he says, leaders are the ones who run headfirst into the unknown. They rush toward the danger. They put their own interests aside to protect us or pull us into the future. Leaders would sooner sacrifice what is theirs to save what is ours, and they would never sacrifice what is ours to save what is theirs. This is what it means to be a leader. It means they choose to go first into danger, headfirst toward the unknown. And when we feel sure they will keep us safe, we will march behind them and work tirelessly to see their visions come to life and proudly call ourselves their followers. Now, that is an extremely idealized version of a leader, obviously, but you can see the spirit of that is that leaders do the thing that's the hard thing. And when they do the hard thing, we want to follow them. And there's a lot of times where people who are in your ministry and my ministry or on your team or my team, they're looking to you and I, and they're kind of deciding how you handle this situation that's unresolved is going to determine a lot about how I follow. I was talking to a friend of mine in ministry who's a pastor, and there was a person on his staff that was causing a lot of disruption. And this was a very well-networked person, and to deal with them was going to cause a lot of evil. And one of the things, he finally got to the point where he knew he had to do something, and so he dealt with this person, and it was messy, and they leveraged their network in the church, and it was a really hard thing, and he had to work through it with the elders, and it was ultimately, though, they reached a place where this person was moved on, and that from all of outside observation seemed like the right thing. And this is what he said. He said, the thing I wasn't expecting was that suddenly the productivity of the rest of the staff leapt forward when this person was gone. What he didn't understand and what we don't always calculate is when we don't deal with conflict or when we don't deal with difficult conversations that we need to deal with, it may be costing us far more than we think. Because the math we do is, what's it going to cost me? And the pain that it's going to cost me. But it may be costing your team and your organization far more than we realize. There may be people that are waiting for you to have a conversation, and when you do, you're going to see full engagement. All right, so let's talk about, we're there now, how do we do it? Three things to do. Letter A, work hard to uncover the real issue. Before the conversation, there is some really significant work. I know that seems really obvious, but there's some really significant work to do to actually do this. So at the heart of every difficult conversation is a reality that needs to be addressed. This is the thing that I said before, is that pebble in your shoe, that thing that won't go away. It's the thing you're driving home having imaginary conversations about. And I'm going to represent it by this prop right here, this ball. This right here, this prickly thing, this is kind of the real issue, all right? So I think we have a slide. So here's the two of us, and we've got something between us. That's what this is. It's the real issue. But actually, this thing I've found is a lot harder to figure out what it is than we think, because there's layers of stuff that are covering this up. So this might be the real issue, but it feels like this. Right? And the reason it feels like this is because there's all kinds of layers that are covering up. So what happens is if I go to you and I have a conversation and the issue feels like this, it's clouded by all these other layers. So before I even get there, I have to figure out how do I do the hard work of reducing it down to what it really is. This is kind of what I feel like I've learned in this process was, like, I didn't have any problem. Whether it was this or this, I would just go to you and go, here you go, and we'll just deal with whatever that is. And as you can imagine, that's not terribly productive. And one of the things I feel like the Lord kind of taught me was that what it means to take thoughts captive is not just to identify thoughts, but also interrogate those thoughts. That's the part of it that I never really feel like I understood, was part of taking thoughts captive is also interrogating them. And what happens when you interrogate your thoughts and really do the work we're going to talk about here, you start to peel away those layers. So those layers that are on top of our issue, we're not ready to have the conversation yet. There's actually some work we got to do on the side. So the first step actually away from the conversation to do this business is discovering, running the what is the issue through the four C's. Now, the four C's is a filter that I use and that we use as an organization a lot, and you may have another filter, but I'm going to talk about the one I use. So the four C's are this. Character. Most issues are rooted in one of the four C's. Character, chemistry, culture, and competence. Now, character can be a moral thing, and it can also be a non-moral thing. It can be a work ethic thing. It can be a lot of different things. Actually, you know, in processing over time that talk with Tim, one of the things that was playing into the conversation and complicating it was Tim had a huge need for approval. And when I was coming to him to sort of articulate something that wasn't working out, it was stepping on a nerve of approval that had really nothing really to do specifically with the professional stuff we were talking about, but it was complicating that. So character can be things that are moral, it can be non-moral things. Chemistry is man, there's just something I don't feel like we're connecting, and there's something maybe that's bugging me or whatever. And sometimes it's with you, and sometimes it's with the team. Like, it isn't with you. You're fine, but people are coming to you saying, hey, would you deal with so-and-so? Would you deal with so-and-so? Culture is just different values. Every church has a culture. North Point has a culture. Not everybody is a fit for the North Point culture. There was somebody on my team years ago, and one of the things that bothered them about North Point was the way North Point spent money. And North Point, you know, one of the things that North Point will often do is, you know, at the sermon series, they might have a magnet or produce some sort of trinket that goes along with the series to help people remember or whatever. And that was something that really, really bothered this person. And part of that was just their value because of how they grew up and the stewardship lessons they were taught and kind of the churches they had grown up in and how they treated money. And honestly, it was a completely legitimate perspective and view. However, North Point made its value decision about how it does that, and this person could never quite get over that. And ultimately, they left the organization, and it wasn't bitter and it wasn't acrimonious, but part of why they left was they just realized, I'm not a cultural fit. Their character was fine, the chemistry was fine, but culturally, they just realized, you know what, this is bugging me more than it should, and I can't let it go. So when North Point built a bridge to get cars off its campus, they just couldn't, you know, deal with that. So sometimes your church and our church, we have cultural differences, and that may be the root of the issue. Which is, do they lack the skills? Sometimes they lack the skills because we haven't trained them, and sometimes they just lack the skills because it's not their wiring or gifting. So this is the first filter. So if you have our conversation that needs to happen, one of the things that's happening before it can even happen is there's a step away. And I don't know if, yeah, there we go, a step away. So now we've run it through this first filter, like what is it? Which one of these is it? And you may have your own filter, but when we do that, we kind of remove a layer and we get a little bit closer to what the issue really is. The second thing is letter B, calculate the influence of design differences. Calculate the influence of design differences. This is my broad category for number one here. All of us are a combination of wiring, personality, experience, values, and more. So, you know, a lot of you have taken temperament tests and personality. You know, there's wirings like the Myers-Briggs, where you have thinkers, people who approach problems with information first, and you have feelers, which are, you know, people who approach the same information with feelings first. So you may have, you know, what may be at the root of a lot of what's at the root of my wife and I's issues is this difference right here. She's a feeler and I'm a thinker, and that's been the source of endless growth opportunities for me. So part of it can be a wiring thing. Part of it's a personality thing. One of the differences between Tim and I is I have a more of a results orientation. I value relationships, but my tendency is to value results a little higher, and I have to work to maintain that balance. And Tim is really, really high on relationships. And so one of the things coming into our conversation was I was really dialed in on results, results, results. And Tim saw relationships as results. And that's not untrue. But part of what was happening was we were looking at the same job description and we were interpreting it differently. And part of that was just the way we see the world. It's not right or wrong, but it was complicating our issue. Part of it's experiences like organizational history and other things. And then there's culture, gifting, gender, all kinds of layers of complications. So you can see there's all these layers that are going on top of our issue. And part of our process in moving away is to peel those back. So our second step back away from the conversation has to do with this calculating design differences. So you take that second step back and you peel off that layer. And I think that's the next slide. Do we have the next slide where it's the, there you go, Brad. Sorry, I forgot that one. Our designs inform our perspective, and all perspectives are incomplete and biased. That's the blank on number two. This is important because Just as 1 Corinthians 12 tells us that we're all parts of the body, but we're a specific part, nobody's all one part, I think the temptation for all of us, and it's why Paul wrote, hey, the hands can't just gather his hands and say we don't need the feet, because the reason he wrote that is because he knows that's the temptation for all of us. The temptation for all of us is to surround ourselves with like-minded people and see the world through our lens, because it's clear through our lens. Like, if you would just get on the same page, everything would work out, you know? And our tendency is to see other people as flawed versions of ourselves. And maybe God designed them different. And so one of the things that's important is realizing mentally, and for me, it has to be an intellectual decision where I go, my perspective on this issue is biased. It's incomplete. Somehow, there's no such thing as perfect information. The reason that's an important decision for me to make during this period before the conversation happens is, if I don't create space to learn something, then I go into the conversation armed for bear. It's like, I've already decided what's true, I've already decided what's wrong with you, and I'm here to tell you what that is so you can fix it. And that isn't always true, and if you've done that, like I have, what you find out is, you get halfway through your presentation, and they go, did you know this? And it's like, uh-oh, that would have been helpful. I probably would have decided differently, you know? And that lack of curiosity is problematic in a difficult conversation. So what happens is, if you can intellectually reach the place of going, I am biased, then you can create space for that curiosity. Letter C, reduce this third step here, reduce the, and this is a very technical term, noise. Reduce the noise to a minimum before the first conversation. I just couldn't figure out a better name for that. But noise is just on top of what is the 4C's filter issue, on top of our wiring experiences, gender, all those complicating differences, on top of all that, unfortunately, is just the sin nature in the flesh. There's the fall. So what happens is the noise creates this other layer that energizes that conversation to a different degree, which is just our flesh, our sin nature, energizing our differences. And that's another thing we have to work at, because, you know, Satan, in my experience, is an absolute expert at dividing people, dividing your relationships, dividing your marriage, dividing your relationship with your kids, dividing your relationship. And the way that I understand all that working is that somehow in partnership, my sin nature partners with an enemy that is at work to undermine my relationships, my ministry, all of it. And what you've seen, what I've seen, is if Satan can get in there and undermine a leadership team of a church, he can undermine the whole church. Or if he can undermine the marriage, he can undermine the whole family. And so there's something that is, especially I think in the work that you're doing and we're doing, where Satan is working very, very hard. And I think the scriptures kind of reveal that we're to pray for protection against this, we're to guard against this, that there's something at work to undermine, which is also factoring into these conversations. So number two, the noise interferes with our ability to see clearly and respond productively. If we don't take time to process this, it will overwhelm the conversation. So if I get clarity around, I think I know what the 4C's issue is for this situation, I think I've factored in our differences, but I haven't done the process of going before the Lord, I can still have it at this level. And it can. And what's going to happen is it's going to make it unproductive, because it's going to be my flesh and your flesh just hitting each other, and it's going to be very little. So one of the pieces that kind of came up during this process in my conversation with Tim was I realized that part of what was increasing my angst over this was that I had, now that Tim was on my team, and again, I had decided to make a judgment on some things he was doing that I didn't think were as helpful, as productive as they needed to be. But what was energizing, the truth was, when I peeled it back, that part of what was energizing my angst was that I was thinking, you are making me look bad, or you're going to make me look bad. So it wasn't about him. It was about me. It was, at least part of it was about me. So I could say, this is the loving thing to do, but actually part of it was, I don't want you to make me look bad. And I had to do business with that before I talked to him, because if I had brought that into that conversation and it was about me, you making me look bad, somehow that would produce unproductive results. So that's part of reducing that noise. So let me quickly talk about four keys to effectiveness. Letter A, healthy detachment is a good indicator of readiness. What healthy detachment is the two extremes are, unhealthy detachment is, I don't care, I could care less, and unhealthy attachment is codependent. So Healthy detachment is reaching that place where we are no longer emotionally hooked. Now, you won't be able to reduce this to zero. At least in my experience, I haven't been able to reduce this to zero. But it's getting to that place where now there is, I feel like at least the majority of my motivation is coming from love. I've done the work of doing those filters. And now I'm at the place where I am actually genuinely curious in approaching this person. There is some sincere curiosity. And that healthy detachment, where it's mostly about them and I'm not emotionally hooked, that is an indicator for me that I'm ready to have the conversation. So that's when I can move towards them. Okay, so we've peeled back our three key layers. Now we're ready to have the conversation. So what does that look like? Begin the conversation, letter B, with genuine curiosity by asking discovery-based questions. Now, you cannot fake this or do this without reaching healthy detachment. You cannot fake curiosity, and you can't ask discovery-based questions. I've tried. You can't fake it, because they end up sounding like this. A discovery-based question is a question that's not loaded, it's open-ended, and it generally wants to discover information. And a non-discovery-based question sounds like, hey, you know, it seems like a competent employee would have done X. You did Y. Can you help me understand that? You know what I mean? It's like, that's a loaded question. A discovery-based question is just simply, can you help me understand what your thought process was getting to this? Now, you may have decided, you may be even right about the decision-making process, but there's always space to learn something. And when you ask discovery-based questions, even if it confirms your suspicions, you're not going to be surprised by information that you didn't see. But a lot of times, most of the time, what happens is I discover information I didn't have before, and it influences the way I see the issue. And a lot of times, it can come out. You see this in groups all the time, okay? So, like, in your small group, before you've had a chance to tell each other your stories, and you're relating to this person's behavior in your small group, right? And they're just controlling, and they're just intense, and they need to just relax. But something's driving it. So you're responding to their behavior in your small group, and it's like, dial it back, you know? And then you tell stories, right? And this person tells you the story about growing up in an alcoholic home where it was chaotic, and if you have a history of alcoholism in your family, like I do, you know, what happens is people who are the children of alcoholics, they grow up in such chaotic situations. In adult life, they try to control things because they didn't have any control as children. And so suddenly you realize, okay, the behaviors that I'm reacting to are driven by a very painful story. And I don't know for you and for me, when I hear that context, it changes the way I feel about what's going on. I was at dinner with a friend last night, and he made this comment, and it wasn't about this talk, but I thought about it. He said, grace is interacting with someone's heart, not their behaviors. And I thought about that, like, a lot of times when it comes to difficult conversations, what drives us to the point of needing to have one is the behavioral level. But when we're ready to have one is kind of when we're at the heart level. So, letter C, find emotional common ground to help the other person see what you see. Whether you are like me and you're more wired as a thinker than a feeler, or my wife, who's wired more as a feeler than a thinker, we're all combinations of both. And the truth is, whatever this issue is, it's a combination of facts and feelings. And one of us might look at it and say, I see more facts than feelings, and the other one may see it the other way around. But if you want to have an effective conversation, what I have found is you have to marry both facts and feelings. And one of the best places, if you have time to look at this, is to read in 2 Samuel 12, where Nathan confronts David about his adultery with Bathsheba. You think about a difficult conversation. You know, imagine having God telling you, hey, I need you to go confront David about adultery and murder. And, you know, if you're Nathan, you're like, can you say that at least twice? Because, you know, that's a tough one. So here you are confronting a man who has already put someone to death to cover his adultery and has the power to put you to death. How do you approach that? Is that the time for bluntness? If you remember what Nathan does, he decides to leverage a feeling in David before he brings his attention to the facts. And what he does is he tells him a story about a guy who had a little lamb, one little lamb, and there was this rich guy who had tons, and he wanted to kill one and eat it, so he grabbed this guy's little lamb and he killed it. Now, before David was king, what was he? Shepherd, right? He knew what it felt like to care for little lambs. And David gets so fired up by this story. Do you remember what he says? What does he want to do to this fictional lamb killer? death, right? It's like, whoa, a little extreme. But Nathan, what does Nathan do in that moment? Glad you said that. That's how God feels about what you did. So, and the effect that it had on David was instantly repentant because the facts and the feelings came together in a thunderclap, right? The way this works, it's very helpful and effective, as my wife and I modeled just 2 days ago, is when you're looking at the issue, you have certain feelings about it, but the other person may feel very differently. So if you can find the equivalent emotion in their world, and you can leverage that emotion onto the issue, now you have some more common ground. So what this looked like between my wife and I was my wife said something like this. She said, Justin, you know how you feel about that? That's how I feel about this. She knows me well enough to know it's not that I don't have that feeling, but my version of that feeling is directed towards that. But what it did was it moved me closer to understanding her angst about the issue. And it's just what Nathan did. So if you can know the person you're talking to well enough and leverage a common emotion, it can be very, 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 very powerful. And one of the bottom lines associated with this idea is to see what you see, they must feel what you feel. To see what you see, they must feel what you feel. If you can remember, if I want this person to see it from my perspective, is there a story? Is there a metaphor? Is there something from their life I can leverage to help them feel what I'm feeling? Even if it's about something totally different, to leverage that emotion is actually very, very powerful. Letter D, have realistic expectations for the first conversation. There's a book that I read by a woman named Sharon Morris May, who's both a therapist and a scientist, and she wrote a book, this will shock you knowing my personality, that my wife and I read a book, How to Argue So Your Spouse Will Listen. So that's the title of the book. I know you're surprised I had to read that, but this woman, who's both a therapist and a scientist, one of the things she talks about is the physiology of what happens during an argument with your spouse, which is the same thing in any difficult conversation. And what she talks about is that during an argument, your brain goes through exactly the same thing that your brain goes through when it's in danger. So if you're out on a path and you're hiking in the mountains and a grizzly bear, you know, comes across the path, what happens is your brain, this little almond-shaped thing called the amygdala, and if you're a biology major or scientist, I apologize if I'm wrecking this, just fake like this is true. But at least what I understand is that this little almond-shaped gland in your brain called the amygdala produces chemicals that cause your brain to focus intensely on the survival mechanism. It's why when you see the grizzly bear, you don't think about the grocery list, because your brain is dialed in on tunnel vision, we got to survive, we don't want to be attacked. Now, the interesting thing is that same survival mechanism physiologically happens during arguments. And it's why you feel people shutting down, partly. So the reason I tell you this is because sometimes for us, we've worked up all this nerve and energy to have the conversation. So by the time we actually pull the trigger, it's like, here it comes, dump, 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 dump. I've been sitting on this for 2 months. And then we're somewhat surprised that nobody retained anything on the other end. But one of the things to remember is that the person that you're talking to may not be, you know, they may be fighting their own physiology in that moment. And so that really you want to walk away from that first conversation with just one idea, one thing to pass on. I remember with Tim, it was just, Tim, you need to know something needs to change. Whatever this first meeting looks like, something needs to change. So real quickly in the follow-up here. A, reestablish the communication as quickly as possible. Now, you might be, you know, the reason to do this is because it communicates we actually care. There was a colleague of mine on staff here who confronted me about something he observed, my behavior, and I was so mad at him when he did it. I mean, he was right, but I wasn't willing to admit it was right, and I was super mad, and he knew I was mad, so he emailed me or texted me that night saying, hey man, just thinking about you, wondering how you're doing, you know, and let's get together. I wasn't about to answer him. That dude was in deep timeout with me. Like, you know, he was going to be punished. So, you know, how dare he, right? So, but in hindsight, let me tell you this. I wasn't willing to receive his movement towards me in that moment. But I look back on that and I realize I interpreted that as that was genuine care for me. And so make sure to communicate quickly and give them permission. You know, one of the things I remember telling Tim was, hey, man, you're going to be mad at me. At the time, he was really upset that I was having this conversation. He wasn't mad yet, but I knew he would get there. And I said, you're going to be mad, and that's okay. That's normal, and I want to work through all that. But I think giving them permission in that moment to go through the cycle of grief they're going to go through, which includes anger, is important. Letter B, affirm that you're for them. Say it, email it, they won't feel it, but prepare for the distance, the awkwardness, and the mess of it. There's just no getting around that. Like, here's what I was thinking as Tim was leaving that day. Tim is super well-networked in this church. Everyone loves Tim. Not everybody loves me. I could see Tim going back and telling his friends, you know, what happened and them being upset at me. And I don't blame them. If it was my friend, I'd be upset. I could imagine in my mind Tim going and telling his wife, Suzanne, who I really like, who is suddenly going to not like me at all. And I don't blame her because it's her husband and she should feel that for him. And I knew that I was going to be walking in the halls of the church, and thankfully of a big church, so I could hide. But there's that part of it that you just have to deal with and work through. And in time, if you're driven from this place of love, I think that will drive it. Now, they all don't go well. Dolls is not neat bows on all of them, but it helps. Letter C, ask what they heard. During the conversation or afterwards, pause and ask, what are you hearing? And expect the answers to be different than what are you communicating. And letter D, schedule up follow conversation or conversations right away. In my experience, there's been at least three conversations that have to happen. Part one is the hard conversation where I'm trying to communicate one thing. Conversation two is, what did you hear? Not much more than that. And then conversation three is the meeting of the minds. Just keep in mind there's a danger if too much time passes. Now, the reason I think this is important is not just because it's a skill we all have to get better at, but I see and I've experienced many churches that are far better at talking about people than they are talking to people. And that undermines the effectiveness of our leadership and our ministries. And what I would love to see in my world and in your world is a culture where we handle conflict well and we have the difficult conversations, because a lot of people are waiting for that. And the better we do that, the more safe and secure people feel, and that's my desire. So what I want to do now is I want to invite Tim up, actually, so you can hear from him, because, you know, he is wired very differently than me, and he's probably wired more like many of you. And partly, I want you to see that we're still friends.
I feel like we should hug or something right at the beginning of
right.
this.
No. But here's what. Grab that chair. I'll grab another chair. You got one? Okay.
Yeah.
So I want you to hear from Tim's perspective a little bit, because Tim is somebody who probably wouldn't be described on their 360 as a conflict-friendly personality, right? And here's the other good news about you for this, is that Tim no longer works for me, so he can say whatever he wants.
Right,
so
we used to do this talk when I worked for him. He's like, say really nice things at the top.
Right.
And I was like,
so filter's off now.
Yeah, I don't have to.
Why don't you share a little bit about your perspective?
And this was 5 years ago now, maybe.
Yeah.
And the thing I knew sitting down that Justin can't share that's probably the most important is, when we sat down, I knew nobody worked harder on their stuff than the guy that was going to tell me about my stuff. So from the get-go, I was not sitting there thinking, yeah, but look at you. Like, I didn't have that bullet in the gun. Because especially, I mean, we're wired very differently. We've worked together for years, and he's one of my closest friends. We do Thanksgiving together. And it's all been good. But the thing that is so different, I'm a high feeler on the Myers-Briggs, but the crazy thing about that is, when you can identify the bad guy, especially as a feeler, you feel like you've got nothing to work on. But Justin's character was so high that I couldn't even sit there from him and go, yeah, but you wouldn't work on this. Like, you wouldn't be doing this. So I knew in that moment that he was kind of the pace setter for this. And this was the most loving thing for me, because he talked about it was a need for approval. It was deeper than that. It was a need for validation. And it was, stuff was going on with my dad that God was working on in my life. And we were popping out kids left and right, so we had more kids at home than I knew what to do with, and so it's all falling apart. And God, and what Justin was feeling is, in one part, just my career, God was doing in all parts of my life, and it turned out to be the most loving thing that could happen to me, because that's what helped set in motion a whole different kind of path for my future in my life. So that started back then.
Talk a little bit about the relation, like, for you being so relationally gifted and wired, what you've learned about this particular issue when it comes to...
Well, and that. I, you know, we all take the strengths finders and we all take those different things. And the strength finder, when I take it, the number one is woo. And that's a strength. That's not something I, you know, it's something I was given. It's not something I, you know, cultivated and worked hard on. We all have strengths. Nobody takes the strengths test and it comes back, sorry. You know, like, oh, sorry. Nobody gets that, right? So I had this, but I had bounced around 2 years in Ohio, 2 years in Colorado, 2 years in Michigan, and now I was 2 years into Atlanta, and I had come to the end of my woo. There was nothing beyond that. Like, it had worked well for 2 years, and all of a sudden, I had 2 years of woo, and Justin was like, yeah, not impressed. So what happened was, and do you remember this? There was a part in the talk where he was like, I need you to work on professionalism. Mm-hmm. And I look back in the toolbox, and I'm like, this is so embarrassing now. But I look back in the toolbox, and I'm like, okay, professionalism. Maybe I should wear khakis more. Like, maybe I should start dressing nicer. I don't know what else to do. But I had not been at the place where I had come to the end of that, and it could not have been a more loving thing to say, hey, I want you to develop more than this. And it took kind of a bigger, shocking, hey, this is not working out so well, to get my attention and get me moving in the right direction. But the thing that kind of made sense to me was my whole life with woo, you're told, oh, you're so relational. But all that really means is you're really conversational. Because relationships add the love component, and the love component adds conflict. Because if I'm not, you know, being conversational is really being nice, but nice is not loving. I had a friend visually kind of pair this out for me, and he was like, I think nice is way closer to sin than to love. And I was just like, I want to be nice. I want to be harmonious. I don't want to rock the boat. You know, I want to keep things on this level. But the crazy thing, and I wrote this down, my wiring, your wiring, is a terrible excuse to overindulge or neglect any behavior. So I was relational. So I want to be harmonious. I want them to like me. I've got a need for validation. You know, I don't want to have a difficult conversation. But the problem is, if I'm going to be in leadership, if I'm going to love people, which is why I'm doing this, it's why I got into ministry, was to love people. If I'm going to do that, it's got to come with conflict. And yeah, I might not be wired to have the difficult conversation. Some of us might be wired to have it more. Some of us might like it more. But that's a terrible excuse to neglect that or to overindulge in it, to just go gung-ho on it. So it was the kind of thing that it was like, I needed to work on this. I mean,
I saw you grow in this. I mean, I sat there with Tim when he removed a starting point leader, somebody who has volunteered to share the gospel with people. And Tim, there were some things that came up that this person, we didn't go into the meeting deciding they were going to be removed, but we went into the meeting knowing if what was true, we were going to have to do it. And I just sat there, and Tim, I watched Tim, this was several years after, but the growth that had happened, here's somebody that had you met 5 years ago, conflict engagement or difficult conversations would have been very low on the to-do, and yet he was charged with protecting our starting point ministry. And here we had a leader that was not safe or not healthy, and Tim had to go in there and remove them, and I watched him handle it with such incredible grace and skill. And what it proved to me was whether you're wiring more blunt like me or whether you're not, like, this is something we can all grow in, and Tim's done a great job. And the thing I love about having Tim, not only to show you that I think on the other side of our conversation, if our relationship was going to have any real integrity or depth, we had to go through that rough patch. Mm-hmm. And our friendship only deepened from there. And that's something to remember. Now, they all don't go well. There's not a bow on all these. I've got plenty of people that would, you know, throw something at me right
talk.
Now. Right, not do the talk. But it's just to show you that I think sometimes we just see the conflict, but we don't see what God has in store beyond it.
Right.
And what I couldn't have calculated that day was that God was at work to use that as a catalyst for some other things he was working on with Tim. Stuff I had no idea about, stuff I wasn't smart enough to know, but that God was using that. And that's part of the math we don't always see. So if God is drawing you into that, who knows? He may be using you as a tool for that. So,
and you know, you sign up to do this talk, and of course, one of the most difficult conversations I've ever had was 2 weeks ago. We should have the talk,
right?
Like, what to do with all this money. We should sign up for that
talk and then
see what God does. But so I had this conversation a couple weeks ago, and it's the hardest one I've ever had, because it ties deep relationships, which I care about, and stuff that I've got to help bring to light. And I realized one of the things that, I mean, Justin gave me permission to engage in that in a way I never had before. But the thing that I spent so much time and energy on was convincing. I felt like I had to go in and convince people of what was going on. But I think a mutual friend of ours has helped me amazingly with awareness for the other person is the goal, not convincing them. So questions, stories, and metaphors become your friend. So I told, this is 2 weeks ago, I'm sitting on a buddy's porch talking to another person, and I tell that story about the wearing khakis to develop professionalism, because I had no ideas, but it was a metaphor, and I was like, I think you've come to the end of your gifts with this particular thing. And it was a metaphor to help reach in to cause awareness in that person. Instead of trying to convince them, it's pulling into my story to go, hey, how do we create awareness this way? Mm. Which is just a different category. When you are a feeler and when you're relational, you go in there and you make those difficult conversations about you and you're like, okay, I'm right, I can finally do this and convince them. But you've got to get so far out of the way and before the other person to make it possible to be loving.
I love that insight. And I think it connects to the danger when we go in to try to correct a behavior versus realizing that behaviors are driven by deeper things and that awareness takes somebody to the root of whatever those behaviors are.
Yeah.
And so if you and I are just like, would you knock off this behavior? Like, even if we got somebody because of fear of whatever to modify their behaviors at a surface level for our sake or to get along, it wouldn't be the same thing, would it, as getting them at the root. And I think awareness takes them more to the root of whatever is driving the behaviors, which is really what you and I in grace want to do. We want to bring freedom to whatever those things are that are driving the behavior.